position. How's that for a segue, Dan? Open your Bibles to 2 Samuel. David's in a desperate spot. He is on the road fleeing from Jerusalem. Now, the events of chapter 15 and 16 are all taking place within a very narrow window of time, probably just a couple of days. David has heard that Absalom is in open rebellion. Absalom, through his big party at Hebron, had trumpets blown all throughout the land of Israel and proclaimed Absalom as king. David hears about that, realizes he doesn't have near enough manpower to withstand Absalom at this point, so he takes the only option he has open to him, he runs. Some threats, both spiritual and physical, necessitate that you bravely turn your tail and flee. You realize that? I mean, that's spiritually speaking as well. There are some threats you don't face head on. That's why we don't go into strip bars to witness to people, right? It just doesn't make sense. You just run from that. As Paul said, flee youthful lusts, which wage war against the soul. So some things you do just run away from. Well, David recognizes he does not have the manpower to fight Absalom yet. So he's going to entrust himself to the Lord by turning tail and getting out of Jerusalem. He's also gotten his motivation for that. He doesn't want Jerusalem destroyed. Absalom, if Absalom finds David within the city, he'll besiege the city and destroy it until he can get rid of David. That's the rage that he's in right now against his own father. And this has been broiling for years and years and years as Absalom has dreamed about the throne. So we come to chapter 16. David is on the run. He was met by several people on his way out of Jerusalem. And one of those was a man named Hushai, the Archite, a friend of David's, a very wise man, a counselor. And David, instead of asking Hushai to come with him, asks him to stay in Jerusalem and function as a spy. You try to get into the inner counsels of Absalom because you're a well-known counselor. He'll ask you some questions. Well, find out what he's up to and send word to me through the priests, because the priests are also on David's side and they're staying in Jerusalem. And so Hushai went back to Jerusalem. And verse 37 says, Hushai, David's friend, came into the city just as Absalom was entering Jerusalem. Right there, the scene pauses in Jerusalem and goes back to David again. And we're going to follow David for a little while as he exits the city. We'll come back to Jerusalem in just a little bit. So chapter 16, this section is deceitful servants, cursing opponents, and disgraceful sons. If you notice the title, that's a mouthful. That sounds like a Puritan title to a book, right? If you ever read Puritan titles, they're about 14 lines long just for the title. That's why the book itself is usually 800 pages. I once saw a cassette tape series that tells you how long ago it was, and it was 6 45-minute cassette tapes. It was a how-to thing, and it was entitled How to Get Your Point Across in 15 Minutes or Less. And I thought, if it takes him 6 45-minute lessons to get his point across, I don't think he's going to get his point across very effectively. So, when David had passed a little beyond the summit, that's the summit of the Mount of Olives, right? So he's leaving Jerusalem, and as we said before, you crest over the Mount of Olives. That's the last point you're going to be able to look back and see Jerusalem, because the Mount of Olives sits just a little bit higher than Mount Zion. And so you can sit on the Mount of Olives and look down onto the Temple Mount. Had the fantastic opportunity when I was just in college to go to Israel and stay in a hotel built right on top of the Mount of Olives and look out over top of the city at night. Absolutely beautiful. We have a running gag in our house that Kim says she'll have done something really impressive, and I'll say, well, yeah, I did that in Israel. And so it's like one-upping her all the time. So I stayed in this hotel in Israel, right? So Mount of Olives, beautiful place there. So David's cresting the Mount of Olives, This is the last chance he's going to have to see the city for a while. And as he's coming up to the city, another person comes out to meet him. News travels fast in Jerusalem. Everybody knows David is running, all right? And so now here comes to meet him Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him with a couple of donkeys saddled, bearing 200 loaves of bread, 100 bunches of raisins, 100 summer fruits, and a skin of wine. So here comes Ziba. Now, do y'all remember Ziba? Mephibosheth was who? Jonathan's son, right? And several chapters ago, when David was established on the throne, he wanted to renew his covenant of friendship with Jonathan. But Jonathan's dead, so how's he going to do that? He asks around and finds out if there are any descendants of Jonathan or Saul left to whom he can show kindness because of his friendship with Jonathan. That person is Mephibosheth. Now, what's wrong with Mephibosheth? What's that? I'm sorry? Yeah, he's lame. Yeah, he wasn't born that way, but when his mother or his nurse was fleeing with him, she dropped him, and he's lame in both legs. So he's unable to really take care of himself. Well, when David found out about Mephibosheth, he commissioned Ziba. Ziba is one of Saul's servants. Ziba and his sons, and he has 15 of them. He's a prolific man, has 15 sons. And so Ziba and his sons were servants of Saul. David transfers their servantship to Mephibosheth, tells Ziba and his sons to take care of Mephibosheth's land. And so they have been doing that for probably 25 years now. It's been quite a while since David transferred this. Mephibosheth himself lived in Jerusalem, ate at David's table. Well, as David is leaving the city, here comes Ziba with these donkeys loaded with provisions. There's bread there, 200 loaves of bread. That would take a long time to make, wouldn't it? 200 loaves of bread, and 100 bunches of raisins, 100 summer fruits, and a skin of wine. So there's just a bunch of provisions. And David asks Ziba, "Why have you brought these?" And so you wouldn't want to just assume they're there for you, right? So you'd ask, "What's this all about, Ziba? What are you doing with these things?" And so Ziba's answer is, the donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, the bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine for those who faint in the wilderness to drink. So Ziba basically saying, I brought these for you, they're a gift. So if you're tired, you ride on them. Kings shouldn't be walking is the idea that Ziba's saying. You shouldn't be walking as you're going, ride the donkey. Rest yourself, stay strong. And not only stay strong by not walking, but eat this food, it'll refresh you. Even today, cakes made out of raisins. Now, don't think like birthday cake, raisin cake. I don't know about some of you. I'm not a big cooked raisin kind of guy, so it's a little disappointing to me when I bite into a cookie that's got brown lumps in it and they're not chocolate chips, right? And they're raisin. I like oatmeal. I like the oatmeal flavor of a raisin cookie, but I don't like the raisins. So usually if I get one of those, I pick the raisins out, and I eat the oatmeal cookie. So, but don't think like cake like that. This is basically, how many of you like raisins? Okay, I like raisins out of the box. I like fresh raisins. I don't know, can you have a fresh raisin? It is a dried grape, right? It's. But I like raisins. I don't like cooked raisins. So I'd love to take raisins and just eat them. They're yummy. But you know what happens if you open the box and you dump it out? What do you get? You get a brick-shaped raisin, don't you? Because they're all smashed together in there. That's what this cake of raisins is. They would take these raisins and they would push them together into a lump. And then you could hold on to it and you could eat it, right? And it's extremely good for you. Very refreshing. Of course, raisins have a high sugar content. And it's a natural good sugar. So if you're out in the heat and you are exerting yourself, then raisins are a very good thing to eat because they push your blood sugar levels back up, make you feel refreshed, right? So the bread, the raisins, the wine, the summer fruits, all of this stuff, Ziba says, look, I want you to ride on the donkey so you don't get tired. Refresh yourself with this food. It's very good for you, and I don't want you to be fainting in the wilderness. So verse 3, the king said, here's the glaring question, where's your master's son? Obviously referring to the master is Saul, yeah, or Jonathan, right? And the son would be Mephibosheth. So where's Mephibosheth? Probably David was hoping to have a show of support. I mean, after all, this guy has been eating at David's table for years. And David has been supporting him for years. And so he's hoping for a little bit of show of support from him, but boy, the discouragement just keeps coming for David. This is one of those days you really wish you just hadn't got out of bed. You ever have one of those? You probably haven't had one to this extent. Your own son's trying to kill you, you're leaving the city, nobody's standing with you, and every turn you meet, every person that comes up to you is just another problem. And so, where is your master's son? And Ziba said to the king, "Behold, he remains in Jerusalem. For he said, today the house of Israel will give me back the kingdom of my father." Oh, ouch. Talk about a stab in the back. Mephibosheth, I've been supporting you all these years. I lifted you up out of the poverty of your condition of being lame. I restored your family lands to you. I gave you servants to take care of your lands. I fed you at my own table. I treated you like a son. And now you think this is an opportunity for you to regain the kingdom. What a discouragement, right? Now, how many of you know the rest of the story? Okay, we're not going to get to the rest of the story tonight. If you know, then you know what's going on. But I'm not going to give you any spoiler alerts. Except, there's one spoiler alert, and that's in the title of the sermon. Deceitful servants, right? Okay, so maybe don't take everything that Ziba's saying at face value. We'll get to it, though. So, but he presents this very discouraging message. Mephibosheth thinks the house of Israel will go back to him and to his father's house. In other words, Mephibosheth is hoping for a restoration of Saul's dynasty. What's the likelihood that's going to happen? Big fat zero, okay? Why? What's wrong with Mephibosheth? He's lame. He can't lead the armies. He can't be an effective leader. Now, America did elect a man in a wheelchair, and he was an effective leader for a long time, but we have a very different mentality of leadership than they had back then, because one of the primary functions of the king was as the leader of the army, which you can't do when you can't walk. So, probably very little chance that this is going to happen, but David is in such a state of depression and discouragement here that he doesn't think this through much, and he just accepts it at face value. You know, there's a proverb that says it's foolishness to make a decision before you hear both sides of the story. It also says, whoever is the first to present his case seems right until someone comes and examines him. What does that mean? Have you ever heard, you're walking down the street and you hear somebody and they say, did you hear about so-and-so? And they start telling you this story and you think, oh, wow, that sounds completely crazy. I can't believe that. Wow. But you start to buy it. Because it seems to make sense coming from the mouth of that person, right? And you believe it. And you go on about your way saying, I just can't believe so-and-so did such a thing. And then you find out later they didn't, because you know what? There's another side of the story that you didn't hear. But we do this all the time. And David, in his emotionally and mentally weakened state, at all of the stress going on in his life right now, doesn't look into this matter, and he just pronounces a judgment. He hears that Mephibosheth has turned against him and is hoping to have the kingdom restored, and then he says to Ziba, behold, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours. Now what we're trying to do here is look at some of the effects that all this stress is having on David and some of the bad decisions he's making. He's making some good ones, but he's also making some bad ones. And listening to Ziba's testimony about Mephibosheth without hearing the other side is a huge, huge mistake on David's part. He should be able to look and say, wait a second, Mephibosheth has been loyal to me for years and years. I can't imagine him doing this. But what argues against that? His son apparently was loyal to him for years and years too. So at this point, we can kind of understand why David thinks everybody's against him. And so he believes it. And he transfers the title of the property of everything to Ziba. Now Ziba's been working this land for years. So it's probably something he's been wanting for years and years, to have this land himself, and now he's got it. David actually doesn't have the authority to do this. Who gave the people the land? God did. way back when the people entered the land, and Joshua helped them conquer it from the Canaanites and all the other tribes that were there. And then they sat down and they apportioned out the land by lot, which means they drew numbers, basically, for the land. And God apportioned through that means a parcel of land to every family in Israel, and that was passed down from father to son to father to son to father to son for 400 years until we get to David. David does not have the right as king to take land from anybody and transfer it to anybody else. And so it's a little bit of a sign of the weakness that David's in that he thinks, even as king, that he has this kind of power. He doesn't have this kind of power. This is one of those executive orders that shouldn't exist. All right? It's an unbiblical command. David, as the king, doesn't have the right to transfer land. In fact, you didn't even have the right to sell the land outside of your family. God put limitations on that because he wanted the land to remain in the possession of the family to whom it was given. And so if you wanted to sell it, you didn't even really sell it. You leased it out for 50 years until the year of Jubilee, and then it came back to you. Land was a permanent possession. And so David doesn't have the authority to say, Ziba, that land belongs to you now. But he does. And it's, I think, a result of some of the circumstances going on around David. Doesn't make it okay for him to make that decision, but it helps us understand why he's making that decision. Okay. Behold, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours. And Ziba said, I pay homage. Let me ever find favor in your sight, my lord the king. Sounds very good. David's kingship is in a little bit of question right now, isn't it? And so to have somebody acknowledging that he is the king might, hey, that feels good. But what's the old adage? Beware of flatterers. Why? Because they're usually out to get something from you. Okay. So Ziba bows, he falls prostrate before David, pays homage and honor to him because of this decision. So the deceitful servant, we'll find out why that is later. Or if you want to read ahead a little bit, you'll find out. Verse 5, we move on to our second section, which it was deceitful servants. Now we're getting into cursing opponents. As if things weren't bad enough, when David came to Bahurim. Bahurim is a little town just a few miles outside of Jerusalem on the way east. David's traveling east. Jerusalem is right around here, and he's heading eastward towards the Dead Sea. Because at the Dead Sea, he's going to cross the Jordan River and enter what's called the wilderness. If you remember, he told Zadok, the high priest, he was going to go wait at the fords or at the doors of the wilderness. So that's where he's heading, to escape from Absalom. So he gets to Bahurim, which is just a couple miles from Jerusalem. And there came out a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei. Bahurim is a Benjamite town. It was close to where Saul's family resided in Gibeah and Geba. And so it's no surprise that we find a family member of Saul here. So remember, we're about 30 years or so, 32 years into David's reign, but here we're going to find out that not everybody in Israel was really pro-David. There were some undercurrents of people dissatisfied with the Davidic kingdom. And now they feel a little more bold to voice that opinion. They didn't have freedom of the press back in this time. You were not necessarily allowed to say anything you wanted against the current reigning king because he could have you executed for treason if you didn't support him. And so for all these years, these undercurrents have been there. So as people were around the dinner table and they would talk politics, some people would, that David, I can't believe he's doing. Oh, if only the power would come back to Saul's family and we could be kings again, then everything would be great. And so that's been going on, but now it's coming out in the open. There came out a man of the family of the house of Saul whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. And as he came, he cursed continually, and he threw stones at David and at all the servants of the king, servants of King David. And all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. This takes some gumption, I gotta say. David's in this parade. He is fleeing from Jerusalem, but he's surrounded by 600 or more stout warriors and their families. And this guy has the guts to walk up to him and start throwing rocks at him and cursing him. And now don't think like swear word cursing. This is just calling down curses of destruction and mayhem upon David. This guy is happy that David's getting ousted from the kingship. Okay? He probably has a slogan, every Benjaminite life matters. Right? But he's mad. And he's yelling at David. And he's got enough gumption to get out there and throw these stones at David and all of his mighty men. And verse 7, and Shimei, as he cursed, said, get out, you man of blood, you worthless man. This is an example of the cursing that he's doing. So we can understand this isn't profanity that he's shouting, not in that sense of cursing, but he's condemning David. Get out, you man of blood. The Lord has avenged on you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. See, your evil is on you, for you are a man of blood. So, as is usually the case, the most discouraging comments from people are usually built on half-truths, right? What's true about this statement? Is David a man of blood? Kind of hard for David to deny that charge, isn't it? He's fought many wars. He's been the source of a lot of people dying, enemies of the Lord mostly, but he's a man of blood. And he commissioned the death of one of his mighty men, Uriah the Hittite, in order to cover up his sin with Bathsheba. He can't really deny this charge. That must have stung David quite a bit. However, what's the false part of it? Yeah, the Lord taking vengeance on him. Except, didn't God tell David this was going to happen as a result of his sin with Bathsheba? Let's go back to 2 Samuel. And okay, chapter 12, verse 11. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you out of your own house. Where are all these events coming from? This is the hand of God upon David, isn't it? These events are a discipline upon him for his actions with Bathsheba and Uriah. And it comes years later. I mean, again, we're probably talking somewhere between 10 and 12 years after his sin with Bathsheba. Has he been forgiven? Yes, he has. God forgave him. Does that mean all the consequences of his action have been erased? No. Folks, we're told very sternly throughout the Bible, we reap what we sow. And God forgives us, and he accepts us, he welcomes us back as sons and daughters again into full fellowship. And so before God, there's nothing there hindering our fellowship with him, and yet the consequences of our actions continue. That ought to make us say we need to be very careful how we act and how we decide to do things the way God says. So, he can't really even deny that the Lord's bringing this on him, can he? Not really. What part of this message is not true, though? Saul. Whose blood of Saul's house did David shed? Not a single one. What is he probably referring to? Did David have a hand in the death of Jonathan and Saul? No, not really. They died in battle against the Philistines. But wait a second, where was David at the time? Living with the Philistines? That might open him up for a little bit of accusation, might it? It's kind of a bad rap sort of thing. It might be a circumstantial evidence, but somebody could say, look, David, you used the Philistines to oust Saul and Jonathan, make sure they were killed in battle. Because David's used that tactic, hasn't he? Have somebody killed in battle that he wanted gone? Okay. So you see how this might provide enemies of David some ammunition to throw at him. Well, maybe you had a hand in the blood of Jonathan and Saul after all, you wicked man. Who else from Jonathan's house was killed? Sorry, not Jonathan, Saul's house. Remember his son Ish-bosheth? What happened to him? Two of his own servants went into his house and murdered him at Mahanaim. Did David have anything to do with that? No, he actually didn't. But might it look like he had something to do with it? Yeah, you could put those pieces together and maybe make it seem like he did. Would it be in David's interest if Ish-bosheth were eliminated? Sure it would. It worked that way. Ish-bosheth died, and then the rest of Israel joined David. So if you're trying to put pieces together, it looks bad, even though David had nothing to do with it. And then there's the matter of Abner, the son of Ner, one of Saul's relatives. How did he die? Remember, Abner was trying to gather the nation of Israel together to join David while Ish-bosheth was still alive. And he came to Jerusalem. He had a meeting with David. They decided to go forward with this plan. And then who found out about it? Joab. Who's Joab? David's commander of his army. And what did Joab do about it? Pulls Abner aside into a private room and stabs him. And he dies. Joab and his brother Abishai. They did that because Abner had murdered their brother Asahel in battle. Not murdered, but he killed him in battle. And so you have all these deaths surrounding David. And so that we can see how people are putting connections together. Now, we know from an inspired scripture that David didn't have anything to do with those events. But you can see where the Benjaminites are putting these things together and say, this looks really bad for David. And so we have this cursing servant. He's throwing stones at David. He's accusing him of being the downfall of the house of Saul. And he's saying, now the Lord has avenged on you all the blood of the house of Saul. And David really can't defend himself against a couple of those accusations. He knows this is the Lord's hand upon him. And he knows he is a man of blood, even if it's not the blood that Shimei is talking about. So you've got to understand how crushing this has got to be. David has met with almost nothing but discouragement since he left the city. Okay. This is a tough day. This is a day David probably just wishes he could go back to bed. But life marches cruelly onward, doesn't it? Even when those storms come and all those stressful situations are upon us, God does not allow us to just stop and dwell in that moment. You realize that's a mercy of His? And boy, we get into those situations and we really wish we could just stop and have time to think and have time to breathe and figure it all out. But, you know, the next day just keeps coming. Events just keep moving forward, and that's because God is working, even when we don't feel like it. Well then, verse 9, Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, "Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and take off his head." Well, Abishai is Joab's brother. This is one of the guys that helped murder Abner because of their brother Asahel. He's obviously a pretty violent guy. And so he hears this man cursing David, and his response is, "Yeah, let's go take his head off. I can do it pretty easy. I mean, all he's got is rocks. We still have our weapons, right?" And you might be thinking, "Well, maybe that'd be a good idea. Should this guy be cursing the king? Does he deserve to die for that?" Well, you know, maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. But David does, at least recognizes that this is not the point to do that. Somebody's accusing you of being a violent man of blood, might not be the time to kill him. Or you prove his point, don't you? So Abishai's got this idea of, why should this dead dog? They didn't like dogs too much, right? And so calling somebody a dog was an insult. Calling somebody a dead dog was an even worse insult. Because if you don't like dogs, you're surely not going to like dead dogs. The pooch. Yeah. "Why should he curse my king?" But David, here's David's response in verse 10. "What have I to do with you, sons of Zeruiah?" That statement, "What have I to do to you," is like saying, "I don't have anything to do with you. I have nothing in common with you. And what you're saying right now, I stand completely against it." Except he says it in a much more colorful way. Isn't that more fun to say, "What have I to do with you," than to sit there and say, no, that's a bad idea. "I don't have anything in common with what you're saying. My thoughts are nowhere near what your thoughts are. I wasn't even beginning to think of that solution." No, not going to do that. And notice who he blames for this. Sons of Zeruiah. Probably Joab is sitting there saying, yeah, let's go get him. We already know Joab's a violent man. He's murdered several people in his lifetime. He's not opposed to just going off and lopping off people's heads. But David's response is, "If he is cursing because the Lord has said to him, 'Curse David,' who then shall say, 'Why have you done so?'" Oh, that's a great view of sovereignty. If God brings this instance into my life, he's done it for a reason, and I'm not going to argue with him. You ever argue with God? Why'd you bring this? What's this all about? Why are you doing this to me? What did I ever do to deserve this? Most of us have probably been there at some point. Well, David's going to at least have a good response to this and say, no, if God has told him to curse, I'm not going to tell him not to. And look at what he says as he continues here. You think that's bad, him cursing me? David said to Abishai and to all his servants. Now he's not just addressing Abishai and Joab. He turns around and he's addressing everybody in a voice loud enough for them all to hear. Behold, my own son seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjaminite? If my own son, and there's a statement in there that says, who proceeded forth out of my bowels. And just that picture of begetting children and the way that all the mechanics work, right? So he says, if my own son who proceeded forth out of me, shouldn't he be on my side? But if he's not on my side, if my own son's not on my side, then what's the big deal if this Benjaminite, who's not even related to me, wants to curse me? And he's kind of trying to draw a contrast and saying, look, folks, get your head on the big picture here. What's going on? Absalom's trying to kill me. This over here is not a big deal. This is nothing. Let him curse. What's he going to do to us? We might get hit by a rock, but okay. At least we still have our heads on our shoulders and Absalom hasn't caught us yet. Leave him alone and let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. Now he's going to get a little more hopeful. It may be that the Lord will look on the wrong done to me, and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing. So here, David's just transferring all the responsibility for working this situation out to God. You know where he learned this? The years fleeing from Saul in the wilderness, he learned to just let God take care of it. He learned to just let God be the one that decides what happens and don't take things into your own hands. Joab and Abishai from the beginning were men who wanted to take things into their own hands to make sure it worked out. Guess who it was that murdered Abner to make sure that the northern tribes didn't come to David and Abner didn't replace Joab? Well, I just told you. It was Joab. Joab murdered Abner. Guess who it was that suggested that when David went down to the camp of Saul and Saul was laying there sleeping with a spear next to his head, guess who it was that suggested he kill him? Joab. Joab's a guy that likes to take things into his own hands. Contrast that with David, who's a man who trusts God to work things out. Even in the midst of all of the despair and discouragement he's got going on around him and all the people turning against him, David's saying, God's going to straighten this out at some point. God's going to straighten this out. And if he doesn't and I die, God still straightened it out. Now that's faith. That's the kind of faith we're called to constantly, to say God knows what's best. He knows what's happening. He's the one that's going to work this all out, and I just got to sit back and let him. I can only do what I know I'm supposed to do, and I know that I'm not supposed to go lop this guy's head off for yelling at me. So, verse 13, David and his men went on the road, while Shimei went along the hillside opposite him and cursed him as he went, threw stones at him and flung dust. And the king and all the people who were with him arrived weary at the Jordan, and there he refreshed himself. Jordan's about 20 miles from Jerusalem. It's a pretty rough road. Lots of ups and downs. And then you hit the Jordan River Valley, where there's a very long and steep descent. This was a wearying trek for David. Probably took him most of the day. We're not sure what time he left, but most likely all of the events of chapters 15 and 16 happen on one day. Absalom coming into the city, David fleeing, running up the side of the Mount of Olives and then out to the Jordan River. And so it's only when he gets to the Jordan River that he knows he's got a little bit of distance between him and Absalom, and that he's safe now to take a break and let his people refresh themselves. But the whole way, it's been discouragement, 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 discouragement. What's he do? How's David handle it? He just keeps taking one more step in the direction he knows he needs to go. There's a principle when you're counseling people with depression. You know, they didn't used to call it depression. You know, Charles Spurgeon sometimes would spend days and days lying in bed, sick from what he called melancholy, because that's what they used to call it. You know what that is? It's depression. You're spent. You can't get out of bed. You're so discouraged that you don't even want to face the day. And so Charles Spurgeon, the Prince of Preachers, was so exhausted from ministering to people in his church that he would lay in bed for days at a time. And you know what the counsel is to give people who are discouraged to that point, they're depressed? Just do one more thing. It's really simple. Do the next thing. What's the next thing you're supposed to do? It might be get out of bed. And when you've tackled that and you've conquered that mountain, then what's your counsel for them? Do the next thing. Now what are you supposed to do? Am I supposed to get dressed? Yes, get dressed. And that's what David's doing the whole time, is he's facing all this discouragement. And David writes Psalms for us so we know how he's feeling when this is all going on. I mean, don't think that a giant of the faith like David isn't being ripped apart inside because of all this. How would you feel if your son were wanting to kill you? You can pretty much guarantee that's how David felt too. How would you feel if all of your friends and counselors had seemed to turn against you? Well, you can be pretty sure that's how David felt too. He was a man just like us. But in all of his years of following the Lord, he did learn this one lesson, and he's doing it. One more step. I know I got to go that way. I don't know where it's going to lead. I don't know what's going to happen when I get there, but I know I've got to go that way, so I'm just going to keep taking one more step. And eventually he gets to the Jordan, and there he's able to refresh himself and take a break. We're not going to get to disgraceful sons tonight. We'll catch it next week. Folks, even when you're going through a rough patch, just do the next thing. You won't know where it's going to lead. You won't be able to see five steps ahead of you. You barely see one step ahead of you, but you know the next step you're supposed to take. So just strengthen your faith in the Lord and say, well, I got to leave all this to Him, but I know He wants me to do this. And plant your foot one step farther. Let's pray.